Many of you have been here for the two previous sessions, but if I may, for some who haven't, I'd like to take just a few seconds to talk a bit about what's here and why. On August 20th, 1965, the Department of Defense began making regular videotape recordings of the network evening news programs and cutting out of that parts that related specifically to the U.S. involvement in the war. Nearly all of what you saw in the first two programs and most of what is here came from those kinescope recordings. Again, occasionally the quality is extremely poor, and it's never great, because these were frequently films made in Vietnam, color negative, processed, for example, in Tokyo or Hong Kong, sent via satellite, videotaped in New York, sent out over the air, videotaped in Washington, from which was struck a black and white kinescope negative, from which was printed a black and white print, from which I have made a videotape. If you followed that, as I said before, it is the functional equivalent of recording pictures on toilet paper. Sometimes it is the seventh generation. You will notice some differences. Because of the way the kinescopes were made, for example, they were not until later done on Saturday and Sunday, because occasionally pieces were made, and because of a fight between the Defense Department and CBS, I will explain later, I have gotten permission to include from the CBS archives several pieces. I have included here, and I will take a bit more time if I may than last two, because to explain a bit about why I did what. In the first program, I tried to explain as best as possible somewhat the shock and surprise of seeing the war on television, the way television learned to do what it did, the way it learned to cover the war, some of the controversies about that. The second program concentrated, as you know, primarily on the coverage during the Tet Offensive. That has been the most controversial few weeks of the war, the most controversial about the press coverage. There have been several books written about that, and two of the people who have written them were here. I have, in this third thing, tried to give you chronologically a bit about the war from 1968 through 1972. It does not finish up all of it, but to give you a bit of the idea of what was going on at that time. But by 1968, it is important to understand that there was no more, if you will, learning the craft. Many of the reporters who had covered Vietnam in the very early days, in 63, 64, and 65, had been back many times by the period that you will see. The coverage of Vietnam had become routine. Saigon became the largest bureau that any network had outside of Washington, with a budget in all three cases of in the neighborhood of $1 million a year for the coverage, with more correspondents than any place except for Washington, D.C. For example, the typical bureau during 68 to 72 or so was five or six correspondents, a similar number of camera teams, or a total staff of the neighborhood of 30. Covering Saigon was just like covering Atlanta, Washington, New York, or any place else. Many of the young reporters who went to Vietnam in 68, 69, 70 through 75 had seen the coverage before. They had looked at videotapes. They had learned their craft with the people who had produced much of the early coverage. Nearly all of the coverage was in color, but most of what you will see, as I mentioned before, is in black and white. In any case, I should also give a brief preface, if you will, mentioning again those people who have helped me through 10 years of putting much of this together, particularly colleagues at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I ordinarily work, people at the Woodrow Wilson Center across the street in the Smithsonian Institution, where I am now for a year, more than 200 or so reporters, correspondents, producers, and others who have granted me interviews to collect bits and pieces of information, and many more who I will not mention. Again, let me express, several of you have called me on the phone or asked me afterwards about the amounts of material and so forth. I would like to just note briefly that from 1965 to roughly 1975, there are about 4,000 different film pieces coming out of Vietnam by correspondents, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. If you have, and do stick through all three parts here, you will have seen 113 of those pieces. That's 0.3%. You didn't see a lot, but you have seen most of the pieces that were controversial and so forth. In any case, we will start, and somewhat different than before, we'll break a little bit more often this time, and I'll try to explain because we go a bit faster. Thank you. If I can for just a second, if it seems that some of the coverage from that particular period we're looking at, to start it, I just showed you a brief piece of Walter Cronkite on May 13, 1968. All of the anchormen, as you may recall or should know, zipped over to Paris. It was one of the earlier uses of the satellite, with the anchormen live in Paris as the peace talks. The peace talks started on the 10th, but the day you saw was the 13th. But you need to recall that, in large part, a lot of the controversy was going on in this country rather than Vietnam at that time, though the war went on rather unabated. On the 31st of March, 1968, the president said he would not seek re-election, as you know, 10 years ago. On the 4th of April, Martin Luther King was killed. On the 3rd of May, it was agreed that we would have the peace talks, and they were to begin the 10th of May, as they did. On the 4th of June, Robert Kennedy was killed in Los Angeles. The Miami Convention in Chicago was riotous, but the one in Chicago was even more so. And that fall, Vice President Agnew began a rather orchestrated and continued attack against press coverage of Vietnam in general. In any case, the war was changing, too. President Johnson and Secretary of Defense Clifford had introduced what would later be called by Secretary of Defense Laird Vietnamization, and there was a lot of focus, not in what you've seen here, but a lot of focus on what was going on, of course, in Cambodia and Laos as well. In any case, what I tried to show you here is some of the other kinds of coverage that were going on at the same time. I don't mean to imply that there was not regular coverage of the war, but certainly there was not coverage of heavy action involving American troops, as there had been previously. Okay, again. We're starting now in November of 1969. A short break between reels, and I would, again, if I may, like to explain a couple of things. In spite of what some people seem to think, most Americans do not watch the network evening news each night. In fact, only about 25% do, which means about 75% don't. If you had been watching on November 3rd, 1969 on CBS, you would have seen the Webster stabbing story, which you saw part of again. On NBC, the Hager beating story. But an unusual example of two different views you would have gotten if you happened to be watching the very same night. In the same Robert Hager piece, you got an example of how covering the war sometimes worked, because having gotten back with that film, they were still at the daily briefing, which you heard talk about last time, the so-called 5 o'clock follies. So they had a bit of an advantage on the briefer in asking specific questions about specific kinds of actions, even though the briefer had no knowledge of the particular incident. The cameraman on the Richard Threlkeld piece called the Volcano, Dong Van Ri, as you may know, was later killed in Vietnam in an accident during the typhoon when he picked up a live electrical wire helping some refugees. The Frank Mariano story is an interesting example of how the war got covered. At that time, Frank Mariano was a stringer for ABC, not a regular correspondent as he was later. But at that particular time, during the Cambodian invasion, Frank Reynolds was there, as you saw, and a bunch of other stars. And when you're a stringer, you don't get on if stars are in country. So Frank Mariano chose to be out at a faraway fire base, as he said, in Cambodia, and just happened on that particular story. It was nominated for an Emmy in that year. As you might know if you were here the first time, the Webster story was especially significant because Don Webster had been involved in an earlier controversy with the DOD when film of an ear-cutting incident was shown. And as was the case in that particular case, it's a very long story. I don't want to tell you all of it, or can't. It involved an eventual court-martial, but in the ear-cutting instance you saw, I did not explain last time that it was later alleged and proved that the cameraman it had been the cameraman's knife that was used. It was, in this particular case, the cameraman was asked for the knife by an American. He gave it and said, it's now your knife. And the guy said, no, I want to borrow it. And he said, no, I just gave it to you. In any case, a court-martial ensued, and the soldiers were disciplined. However, because of that, The Defense Department had, I don't know quite the right word to use without being slightly inflammatory, but the Defense Department had carefully watched some of the things Don Webster had done. At the time that that piece was on, Clark Mollenhoff had gone to the Defense, gone to the White House as a special advisor to President Nixon, and it was he who used the, got the film and started the investigation. As you saw in the viz behind Cronkite's shoulder, it was the Des Moines Register, where Mollenhoff had formerly and again worked before going to the White House, that used a number of the stories, and then the story was eventually given to Jack Anderson, and that called it's called the CBS organization to produce the film report that you saw. Because of that controversy, the DOD did not videotape and make kinescope recordings of the CBS Evening News during that period. For that reason, the copy you saw was of somewhat better quality because I received that from the CBS archive, as I did the last piece you just saw, which was the last piece that George Sievertson had on the air. At the time that piece was on, George Sievertson was already dead. He had been killed in Cambodia the day before. Next. This is the last short break before we see the end. The Morton Dean report you just saw was one of those that was seen very frequently by correspondents before going to Vietnam. That was broadcast, incidentally, January 22nd, 1971, just before the American invasion of Laos, which the coverage of which itself became controversial. I hope the point is made, as we made in the very first presentation, that by almost the beginning, the coverage of the war itself had become a part of the controversy over the war, and that was especially true as much as it was during Tet, it was during the Laos invasion, particularly because at the beginning of that, for several days, the film was embargoed. That is, as we talked briefly before, the film had been sent to the States, but was not yet on the air. It was held here, but the Defense Department rules did not allow its release. You may recall on a particular Friday night, Harry Reasoner doing a commentary saying that he recommended you stay tuned over the weekend, and the invasion began that weekend. In any case, part of that controversy was over coverage of the South Vietnamese troops and whether or not they were coming, flooding onto helicopters and coming back hanging on the skids of helicopters and so forth. If you look through about 3 months of film, you will find several instances that did happen. I have included two of three simply to make the point that there was film like that, but compared with the coverage in general, that was only a very, very small part of it. One other story requires a brief explanation. You will see in February 14, 1971, during that invasion, a story that George Lewis filed of NBC on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I would, if I could have, included what I consider to be a much better report by Don Webster. First, the incident itself is unusual because of all the talk throughout the entire coverage of the War of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, where it was, what it looked like. It was also tidily and graphically represented on the maps behind the anchormen by arrows coming down and so on and so forth. Not exactly what it looked like. In any case, there was extremely interesting film that Webster had showing signposts along the way, restaurants and so on and so forth. I consider it to be the best report of that particular incident. However, that ran in the CBS evening newscast Sunday night, 11:15, the CBS Sunday night news. And so that is not included in the particular question. You see one that ran the next day. That's enough. We'll see the rest of this and then talk about it. If you'll give it just a second, we'll move this monitor. I'll help you. Did Dick Rosenbaum get here? I'm looking for Dick Rosenbaum. Okay. I wanted to add one note on the Dan Rather piece. The Marines never carried Nixon off the field on their shoulders. That's one of the most unique and interesting accidents of the coverage. If you happen to notice, Nixon was in a car there, and the car drove off, and Nixon was waving his hand, and the Marines and some others were running alongside. A CBS producer, I don't know who it was, so he can remain nameless, in Los Angeles, looking at the film, told correspondent Rather that the Marines had carried him off and said, you can see it in the film, you can see it in the film, and so forth. So that was put into the narration, though it never happened at all. It's a neat optical illusion, or a not-so-neat optical illusion. It does, however, make an important point, I think, and that is by that particular time, that was in April 1971, there was a great deal of controversy over the war. That weekend, there were protests against the war in Washington, D.C., among regular ones then. Nixon scheduled that visit to San Clemente in greeting of the Marines, in part to take news play away from the protests here. At the same time, he had the night before scheduled a television press conference, and the next day, Saturday, scheduled another television press conference. Today, this evening, I guess I should say, to talk a bit more about some of the things you've seen and answer whatever questions you have, to people who did work in Vietnam. Jed Duvall, you met before. Jed Duvall is a correspondent for CBS News. You saw a lot of his younger face tonight. Ed Fui is a producer at CBS. He has been a producer at CBS, a producer at NBC, and a producer at CBS. He was bureau chief of the Saigon Bureau. Let me introduce Jed for just a second and make a couple of remarks, and we'll just try and answer all your questions for as long as you like.
Ralph, with the shotgun, Ralph was shot by Gary Shepard in a film team. And I was at Khe Sanh a week or so after that aired, and an Army captain, a man with a lot of experience, and I thought who should have known better, told us that he initiated a conversation. He said he'd heard that some film company in the United States had hired a bunch of actors and created a scene about GI showing marijuana, and that this film was being shown all over the country, and he thought that was ridiculous because the company had paid for it. And I tried to explain to him that that was real, that Gary Shepard was a real correspondent, that there was a real fire base, and that was really going on everywhere. And he never really quite bought that. He was an information specialist with the 101st Airborne Division, and this was at a far corner of Khe Sanh where they had their particular headquarters. I would like to make one other remark that is personal here. If going backwards through what you've seen this evening, that Route 1 piece at the very end, which involved an awful lot of danger and shooting and everything else, was shot by a man named Norman Lloyd. So was the one before that, the refugees, the two Simon pieces. That business about Charlie Horse and those helicopter pilots was shot by Norman Lloyd. And so was everything else in here that I did. And Norman got there about the same time I did. And I just want to point out that there are a lot of people who are doing a lot of this work that you never got to see, either at home during that time and or in these things. You heard some credits. There was one in that ambush thing, mention of Lloyd, and sometimes there's a super on the screen. This film was shot by so-and-so. But there's always somebody on the other side of that camera. And Norman wasn't, of course, the only one. Is PB Wan here? Well, PB was at the first two, a Vietnamese cameraman employed by CBS here in Washington who was an employee of CBS all through this war. Then that ambush thing, I was hiding in the truck. Lloyd stood up the whole time. He was the only one. He was the only one who stood up. And one more anecdote, because there were an awful lot of combat cameramen that you didn't get to hear much about, but a very famous CBS group of reports was John Lawrence's Charlie Company from that period, 1970. And the cameraman on those was Keith Kay, and the sound man was Jimmy Clevenger. And I was in the bureau one day after several of these had run on the air, and there were a lot of accolades, and indeed one of the Newsweekly magazines had written a little article. And Keith Kay came into the bureau, and was reading this article, and as he went through it said, and John Lawrence took his camera into the jungle again, and Kay just threw the magazine down and said, next time he'll carry the camera himself. I just make that point because they were there. They did a lot of the work. A lot of my stories were Lloyd's ideas. He spent 6 weeks living with those helicopter pilots who were not friendly to an American who wasn't in the service. They did not cotton to reporters. There was a period there in 70, 71 when a lot of the really gung-ho people just didn't want anything to do with reporters, and it was Lloyd who made friends with these people first and had the idea for the story and eased our way into to where they trusted us, and that took a long time.
Go ahead. We'll try and direct. I'll try and direct your questions or answer a few of them or whatever.
I have a question. This last segment of three, it seems that the comradeship seemed to pick up and the view of the war was changed, and I was wondering if that was just this last segment or was that throughout the war?
Ted, you mentioned that once before, but you...
You mean the, like the Charlie horse?
Yeah, the guys enjoyed the time over it.
You mean...
Well,
there were different feelings. He's asking about esprit de corps among the troops. There were different feelings depending what unit you were in. If you were a draftee and a grunt, you really didn't enjoy it there. If you were a pilot, and I don't mean those helicopter pilots, but the jet fighter pilots who were 18,000 feet above the war most of the time, were far removed from Vietnamese, and a lot of them were very hawkish about the war. And a lot of them volunteered for tours again and again, as did many of these pilots. The man you heard in the helicopter saying, we got a gook, nice going, we got a gook, was on his fourth tour. He had been in Vietnam for 38 months. And at the end of his fourth tour, I think he came home, back to Fort Worth, Texas. Morton Dean did a feature on that man that you didn't get to see simply because of time here. But there was a lot of esprit de corps among those people. I don't think that was representative of American troops as a large group. I think just special units with that feeling. Okay?
I certainly didn't deliberately choose those for that particular reason. But yeah, it's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it in that way, but as I said, I didn't deliberately do that. I think one of the points that Jed made in the first session was certainly the attitude of the draftees, the grunt off and against the lifers changed, and I think that was more representative in a piece like Ralph or in the Charlie Company things. I should mention I did not include any of the Charlie Company pieces for one very simple reason, and all of those are collected in a documentary called Charlie Company, which ran as a one-hour primetime, ran twice as a regular television documentary, and while they were included in the evening news coverage, parts of them, I think they stand better by themselves and were never a regular part of it. Go ahead. Yes. I'm not going to answer that. Ed Bowie can answer that.
That's a very difficult question to answer. I spent some time there in 1965 when American troops first were introduced into the war. Spent a lot of time in the northern I Corps area. Went back in 67 and back again in 72. And I think they've fought rather well for the most part. But particularly toward the latter part, the motivation was lacking. I think morale was poor. I think leadership and discipline were also poor. The Army changed from an all-volunteer army, or mainly volunteer army at the beginning, to a heavily draftee army toward the end, so that the change in morale and the change in motivation and attitude was quite easily discerned. I think individual units were extraordinarily well led and performed well. When we think about the kinds of, the AmeriCal division was notoriously poor. That was the unit that that Lieutenant Kelly was with, and I think the slaughter that that he was a part of was clearly a breakdown in discipline. So that I think on a spotty basis, the morale was poor and they performed poorly. So I'm presenting a mixed picture. I don't know. Do you want to disagree with that?
Go ahead. Yeah, there. Let me explain just one bit briefly. In choosing this material, I have been somewhat limited by what is on those reels, particularly in later time period, and that's why I've added some from the archive. For the most part, the DOD would include only material that dealt directly with the U.S. military in Vietnam or Cambodia or Laos. There were several pieces on Phoenix that I can recall, one that Tony Sargent did. That's the only one that comes to mind immediately. And maybe, I think Ed could talk about this better, but let me just say one thing, and that is that kind of story is the kind of story that is extremely difficult for television to do, because it's extremely difficult to get film. And without film, it's awfully hard to talk about things of that sort. But Ed, go ahead, and then you follow. The Phoenix program was described recently by William Coberly, former head of CIA, as an attempt to teach law enforcement to the South Vietnamese. It was a controversial program that dealt with eliminating the enemy by killing them, particularly the so-called Viet Cong leaders in villages. But I can't answer that. I can't, do the whole thing without... There are a lot of different views of what Phoenix did. But maybe you could say something about how difficult it is to get... put together that kind of story from this.
I think you've already mentioned the difficulty of it. It's hard to take a picture of what was essentially an assassination program and a program that operated pretty much at night and in isolated villages. I defer to you because you're the scholar on this. I think we did do Phoenix pieces. I don't really remember, but if you say we did...
Tony Sargent's the only one I
remember. I think... If I might just make one point, what you have seen here tonight is primarily what we call the Bang Bang stories. We did an awful lot of other stories, but there are two reasons why those are not very widely remembered. One is because at occasions like this, we must go back to the Defense Department, which taped only the military stories, and as I recall, only the ones that had U.S. military in them. We did a lot of stories on the ARVN, the Army of South Vietnam. We did a lot of stories, political stories, and we did a lot of pacification stories and other kinds of stories, which were never recorded by the Defense Department in their kinescopes and their archives. They are in the network archives, but that's not a coherent kind of place to put these kinds of things together. So that scholars like Professor Lichty are forced to fall back on the DOD reels and at public showings like this. The second reason is... because of I was once a student in graduate school of communications, and there's a theory of communications known as selective perception, and people remember only what they want to remember. In many cases, of course, it's easier to remember these because they have enormous impact. When a Norman Lloyd is standing up on a truck, incidentally, Jed Duvall is riding in the truck, but these guys are doing a story, it has enormous impact because you can sense, even though it's kind of sanitized coming out of the box, and particularly in black and white and a kind of scratchy kinescope, you can sense the enormous amount of danger that these men are in at that particular time. So you remember those kinds of things, and people who remember the war coverage remember these vivid experiences, but we were doing a great many other kinds of stories. And in fact, I think CBS did a quantitative analysis on how many bang-bang stories vis-a-vis how many pacification / political stories were done, and that's available.
I can't report what theirs, but I can report what mine was, and I did the same thing from 1970 on, and from 1970 on I was not dependent on the DOD Kinney, but a complete analysis of everything that was on ABC, CBS, and NBC, and roughly 13% of the stories would fall into the bang-bang category, which would include battle stories and certain aftermath stories that I called bang-bang. So it represented mathematically a small amount of... Now, your question seemed to be a follow-up for what we're talking about, so go right ahead.
No, it wasn't.
Go ahead anyway.
Okay. Last report. So I'm wondering if you would care to comment from your perspective.
I think that's exactly right. We learned, we spoke here at the first evening. I think Larry pointed out how the first correspondents set the formulas. And I guess what the rest of us did was copied Safer and Lawrence and the others, or maybe used their methods to do our own reporting on the war. I suppose some mixture there. I guess we did learn from what they did. And most people had done those, you know, had done news stories in this country before they went. I was told just before I went by the Saturday evening producer at the time, Paul Greenberg. He said, before you go, I was in the LA Bureau, he said, go in the videotape file and get Al Threlkeld's piece about an individual Vietnamese soldier. It was a very nice feature that Greenberg had run on a Saturday night for 4 or 5 minutes. And he said, I think that's the best one of the whole war, which was a very nice piece about the man's letter to his wife and her letters back to him and so on. It was just very well done. He said, you know, there's one of your models, and mentioned some others. Yeah.
Do you have any ideas on why network television waited until late 1977 to do any documentaries about problems of returning Vietnam veterans 3 years after German and Canadian television ran national documentaries?
Well, okay. Morton Dean, who did that piece on the dust-off, I mentioned a few minutes ago, also did a piece on a Charlie Horse soldier. Morton Dean and I were in Quang Tri Press Center together competing, going after virtually the same story, helicopter soldiers in combat. He zeroed in on this guy from Fort Worth, Texas. And after Dean got, I left there in 71, Dean left there in late 71 or 72. And after he got home, within a year or two, he was doing stories on that guy. And on other guys, Dean kept very careful notes. And he knows, I mean, I didn't remember Ken Gingras's name till tonight, and I wanted to write it down. I think he still lives in Atlanta. But Dean knows everyone he interviewed, knows their hometowns. And as soon as he got home, he went and did stories with him. And I can vividly remember one that must have been before 75, because it was before the fall. And Dean is in Kansas, and the guy's in school, and he has a job, and he's married. And I can still see the films in 74 or 75, a year or two afterwards. Or, yeah, about that time. What I'm saying to you is we did not wait until 77. I haven't done any, but I know CBS News has done a lot of stories on the problems with the returning veteran. Oh, I'm sorry, you said documentary. I don't know.
Let me argue with you just a little. I think that I don't want to be ultra picky. I think in general your point is correct, and the two you're referring to is the recent Steve Bell piece and then Charlie Company Revisited that Bruce Morton did. However, let me point out one incredibly good piece that was done not by the three commercial networks but done by PBS at that time, NET, a piece done by Bill Jersey on PBL in March of 1968 called Goodbye and Good Luck, which is about the difficulty of a black soldier returning to Chicago, played in two parts. It's available for rent if you want to rent it. An absolutely excellent piece which dealt specifically with that problem. However, what you say is essentially correct. There certainly was not the coverage then that there was later, but there were a number of pieces. The most startling was one that ran in 60 Minutes that Mike Wallace did about vet amputees. Why did you say that? I don't know. Probably in 1972 or 3. I'd have to look it up. But the point is, you know, I don't want to be picky. Your general point is correct. Yeah, Bill.
Were there any other major examples during this period of the government in Washington going after a specific story and trying to subvert the credibility of that story?
Okay.
In those two pieces you saw on Ambush, Bill and I were in the same truck for a while. We got started together on that road. It was not far from Quezon at all. In fact, Lai K, where the special forces had been overrun years before. You saw the skulls. We saw the skulls. The ABC cameraman saw the skulls. We all filmed the skulls. The skulls were not fresh skulls. There was not a Sergeant Moat story. Again, the bulldozers the Americans made the road, and they probably unearthed a cemetery or something. And the Army in this country saw that, and they got that film. That kinescope came to Saigon with the film clipped out of it because they took one frame out of that film and blew it up. They took it to the 600th Air Photo Squadron or whatever it was at Tonsonet, which had another job making pictures for awards and things. and they just kept blowing it up until they could read the designation on the track. And they decided what unit it was that was driving those tracks around with the skulls, and they sent two majors, rather expensive executive time. They spent two majors from Saigon all the way to Quang Tri to reprimand the officers of that track for carrying those skulls, that kind of thing. I tried to sneak into Camp Eagle at Fubai, which was the headquarters of the 101st, and was arrested with a camera crew for just trying to go in to see officers and men that I knew that were friends. You know, you had to have an escort, some units, you had to have an escort. The Marines escorted you because they wanted to help you. They were not trying to intimidate your interviewees. The 101st Airborne, you had to have an escort. You had to be an officer. Some units said, you wanted a story? To go do a story. We don't care.
Let me just add, on the ear-cutting incident, which was referred to in that long Webster piece, I was the bureau chief at the time. Don was involved in that. In that incident, along with a cameraman by the name of John Smith, who is a very distinguished photojournalist, and I was called to the military command headquarters, where for the first time I met a brigadier general who was the chief public relations man for the United States Army, a perfectly charming man, who interrogated me at some length and started to make some threats, so I felt I had to leave his office, which I did. But they were attacking our credibility then, and I think rather than my motivation in going to the office, accepting the invitation in the first place, was because I was convinced that they were going to mount an investigation as to why this atrocity had happened and what the various aspects of it were. But they were obviously much more concerned about the public relations aspects. There's one other anecdote, and I don't think I've ever told it publicly before. I'm not sure even to you, Larry. And that is a correspondent who we had a sub-bureau in Da Nang, because it was difficult to get back and forth, take most of the day to get back and forth from Saigon to Da Nang. So we kept a sub-bureau up there, usually at least one correspondent, at least one camera crew, and some logistical support. And the correspondent who was up there when I was the bureau chief in Saigon was doing very tough stories in 67 and the 67 period. And he was also a man with a rather abrasive personality, frankly. And he had several run-ins with the Marines who were running the press center in Da Nang over basically what I felt was that his very tough reporting. Even though it was tough, I felt it was fair. And I made several trips up there just in the normal course of routine operations, and I had met most of the people and had gotten to know some of them. I'm an ex-Marine myself, so I had a particularly good rapport with them at the press center. But one night I got a telephone call that my correspondent was under arrest and was in the brig. I had to go up to find out why, and he had had a run-in with the military police, totally unrelated to his reporting, although I had felt that the Marines were being particularly hard on him because of his reporting. But I was able to get him out of jail, and everything returned to normal for about a month. And then I got another phone call saying that if you do not replace this correspondent, we will kill him the next time he goes out on an operation. And obviously that was a threat of enormous magnitude, because you just could not stand still for that sort of intimidation. At least I couldn't. I don't know, maybe the correspondent didn't share my views. In any case, we resisted that, and to his credit, he continued to hold on his post for another couple of months until his tour ended. But he knew that he was under increased pressure from both sides.
I just referred to it briefly. Maybe I should have said a bit more, but the most extensive example of that was over the Laos coverage, because some senators objected to that there was, in fact, some scene showing South Vietnamese troops coming out hanging in the helicopters. So in the meantime, in the fall of, as you know, in the fall of 1968, the Vanderbilt University had started a television archive that recorded network evening news programs, and a compilation of some of those stories was made and shown in the Senate chambers to some senators who objected to the coverage. But I know of no direct evidence that any of the networks were contacted, other than that there was a flurry in the press about this and some criticisms. Most of the the direct criticism from the White House network came later, more over domestic rather than military criticism. By 1969-70, most of the controversy had to do with television coverage of what was going on in this country rather than Vietnam. Sir.
We have seen a number of scenes of South Vietnamese cowardice and South Vietnamese cruelty. Were there any reports about South Vietnamese heroism?
There were a number. I'm trying to remember back over everything, the 100-and-some-odd pieces here. There were certainly a number, particularly during the Tet period, some of which were included, I think, in the second piece, but the answer would be yes. I can't give you a count. I do have to disagree with what Ed said. He said that there was quite a bit of coverage of the Vietnamese troops themselves. In actual fact, there was a lot less coverage of Arvin than there was of the American forces. I wouldn't say that's just a statistical, that's a mathematical fact. I wouldn't be super critical of that, because I think that when you're doing reporting for American television, that's a perfectly logical decision to make. I have no quarrel with that, but mathematically. I can't give a more complete answer. Certainly the Sievertson piece in the beginning of the Da Nang thing. There were any number of pieces. I did not include in this a particularly important piece, slightly different than Threlkeld. You mentioned Threlkeld, a piece on one Vietnamese soldier and his life and so forth. So there was a number of instances of that, yes. Yeah, Mike Kerr makes reference to that in his book, and I think we mentioned that last time. But
I think it has to in some cases. But for instance, that if you remember Captain Meesey in the tall grass setting the claymores, Lloyd and I were with them for a long time, and you really couldn't speak very loudly. You didn't know where anybody was. We did that interview with him by making a little conspiracy in advance. We were sitting around a cold fire, and they were opening their sea rations, and Norman and I went aside and made a plan. He would pretend to work on his camera and gradually shift it around and shoot it from his lap. And that interview was shot from his lap, sort of glancing down through the viewfinder, you know, sort of. And the microphone was just sort of gradually moved into position. We did a long interview with this guy without any film running while the microphone was just gradually moved around. And Meesey, he knew he was being interviewed, but we had to ease into it, because if you hit especially a young officer, you know, just walk right up to him and go, "Okay, buddy, you're on television." You know, well, of course, I would too, and so would you. So you had to realize when you went to do these stories, were you here the first night when Lawrence hopped off the medevac and this officer says, "What the hell are these people doing here?" Reporters just being present have that same problem. They try to fade into the background, try to become part of the wallpaper. But I mean, you know, if somebody comes in with a camera, it's hard not to. You just have to say to yourself, is what I'm doing being affected by the camera? In that case, you put the camera down and you leave. And we did this a lot in the riots as we became more sophisticated in covering riots in this country from 65 on. And there were plenty of times when as soon as you turn on a light, we just simply turned the light off and left. That's all, because it would draw and yes, the answer to your question is yes, but you had to do your best to work around that, stay away from it. In a war situation, there's not much is going to change when there's combat. I mean, the fighting would go on whether there were cameras there or not. Well, I don't know, because in that case, it's a little bit different. In the first place, it was not an American cameraman. It was a Vietnamese. He would have been in a combat uniform or something very close. He's not going out in a sports shirt. He also has a very small hand camera, a Bell & Howell, and it's a little crank device. He's not loaded with paraphernalia and straps and batteries and all that. It's a little thing, and it's, you know, there could be a guy in the back of this room right now, and we wouldn't know it with that camera.
That was a silent camera, much, much
small yeah, very handy.
It's a telephoto lens, so he could have been 75 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard to know.
I saw another hand. Yeah.